Dobrodošli u još jednu epizodu Bezbedne priče. Današnji gost je dolazi iz Velike Britanije i on je David Wright, izvršni direktor Safer Internet centra, i ono što je interesantno u vezi sa njim je da ima više od 20 godina iskustva u online bezbednosti. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the specific issues around AI, we talk about AI so much these days, and we have so much information around us that can be a little bit confusing. Can you, for start, explain what AI exactly is? Because people who are listening are educators and parents, and I think that they need a little bit of clarification.
Okay. Well, firstly, thank you for the invitation of coming talking today. It's a great thing, and I'm, you know, it's an immense pleasure and an honour as well. So thank you for the invitation to come and talk about a really important subject.
Thank you.
By way of introduction as well, so David Wright, I'm CEO of a UK charity, SWGFL, and a director of the UK Safer Internet Centre. So we're one of 32 national Safer Internet Centres. We have been since 2011, that make up the European InSafe Network. And we're very proud members of the InSafe Network. And I say it's kind of 13, 14 years that we've been the national centre, along with two other charities in the UK as well. That's sort of the work we do, and I'm sure we'll come across lots of that work through the course of this. That's nationally. Internationally as well, there's lots of work that takes us. We work with the United Nations, particularly the ITU, Council of Europe, doing a lot of work with, and also the World Economic Forum. So it's such an important subject globally, but affects everybody at a international, national, and clearly a very, very local, local issue in families the world over. And the issues are largely the same the world over, perhaps in different quantities. But, you know, the use, the adoption of technology is just kind of extraordinary. It's been my career. So I've worked in this space for 20, 25 years, and no 2 days have been the same. It's been an immense, and it continues to be an immense, again, privilege to work in this space. And, you know, so Gen AI, generative AI, in terms of the question, is just the latest form of extraordinary technology. And AI in itself is nothing new. Gosh, it's been talked about, it's been around for decades and decades, but, you know, the current round on the current guise of generative AI technology that we hear so much about in the media is new, is relatively new, has burst onto the scene. And, you know, so in terms of that sorts of technology, so generative AI is usually encapsulated through the example of ChatGPT. You know, so that's how many people will recognize generative AI, will associate it with ChatGPT. ChatGPT is just merely a form of technology, of text prompt technology from OpenAI, a tech company based out of California. Burst onto the scene. Now, what it is a text prompt. So for those that don't know, you just simply, you write a text or a prompt, and it will then produce you some text in response. And it looks like magic. For those that have seen it, it is just an extraordinary thing. So perhaps you've got a difficult email to write, and that's exactly what you do. So in ChatGPT, I need you to help me write an email. It's going to this person. It's got to be about this subject. I want to make this point. It's got to be in this tone. I want it to be this long. And before your very eyes, it will produce you, as if by magic, it will write in front of you exactly that email. So produce you a whole set of text. Extraordinary.
So instead of using 20 minutes to write something, you need 5 maybe?
Or even less. You know, so I think it's just an extraordinary thing as well. So you can also, I'm trying to, I've got this complicated piece of work that I need you to summarize for me. So this report, I want you to give me a short summary of that report. Or I've got to articulate this to a seven-year-old. Can you write it for me in seven-year-old language? So yes, if you've got a complicated report or a complicated concept, and I want you to write this, I've got to explain it to a seven-year-old. How do I explain it to a seven-year-old? And used it like that often actually to explain complicated issues to politicians as well, because it, you know, writing in terms of how somebody else would receive it is not necessarily in your psyche. So it's extraordinary for doing all of that. I think now the way it works in terms of generative AI, what it's doing is just being trained on, I mean, ChatGPT's perspective, on over 300 billion different sorts of data points.
That's a lot of data.
It is a lot of data. And based on all of that data, all in actual fact it's doing is it's just predicting what the next word is going to be, just like my brain's doing, or at least attempting to, right now. It's just working out what it thinks the next word, based on all that training, is likely to be. So just like I'm trying to vocalize right now. So that's all the technology does. It's not working out what to write. It's just predicting what the next word is going to be. Hence, it just essentially just writes itself. Nonetheless, extraordinary technology that's burst onto the scene. And you know, there's actually a lot of examples of text-based generative AI systems. ChatGPT is one of those, but also it's not limited to text. So we see image-based generative AI, so things like DALL-E from OpenAI or Midjourney. So where you type I want you to create an image of a guinea pig playing a saxophone dressed like Elton John, you know, and so it will create exactly that. And make no mistake, these technologies are going to fundamentally change how we use technology. You know, the notion of searching for something on, you know, Google or Bing, when you put a search term in, and we're all familiar with using Google or Bing, you write a search, and what it does, it goes and trawls the web and then comes back with 25,000 responses. This is what I've kind of found. In actual fact, 25,000 responses is really not really much use. Most people clearly just use the first page or perhaps two. Whereas what generative AI is doing is it's taking a synthesis of all it's learnt and tried to aggregate it. And now you start to see, you know, at the top of Google and also Bing searches, you've now started to see the sort of the first box that appears is an AI generated piece of information. That is going to be the future of search. We're not going to be searching the internet in the future. There won't be a notion of Googling something, because it will be a synthesizing everything that it kind of knows and presenting you in the round. Image-based Gen AI, say like Midjourney. Websites, Google image search, or websites like Shutterstock or Getty Images. You know, are great sources of content, but you've often got to pay. There's either copyright issues or you've got to pay for the rights to use images.
Exactly, yes.
Well, if you can create entirely unique and synthetic content that's never been created before on the fly, precisely as you want it, with no cost and no copyright issues, the future of image searching, the future of Shutterstock, they're going to have to evolve into meeting this kind of as well. So, you know, again, examples of how it's going to fundamentally change how we think about, you know, content online. Now we're getting into the realms, and I should say as well that the accuracy, the realism, the hyper-realism of that, the creation of that content, again, just extraordinary. Although we'll come across issues in a moment. video generative AI. Runway. So again, text to video, or Sora. Again, OpenAI have just released this new in beta, this version of Sora. So you write a text prompt. I want you to create me a short clip that does this, features this, is this long, is set in this place. And again, it will go into this. And there's some incredible examples about exactly. So certainly from a Sora perspective, from OpenAI, examples of just the simple text prompt and the production that it then makes. You don't need a film crew. You don't need an actress or an actor. You don't need travel. And it just creates this, amazing kind of video content. Again, before your very eyes, synthetic content. We've seen examples of generative AI creating code, creating 3D models. We've also seen more recently to doing music, so text to music. So I want you to create me music that sounds like this sort of noise, or big band noise, or Irish music. My parents' birthday. I want you to write them a song. Their life has been about this. These have been some highlights. Write me a song in an Irish folk music kind of way. And again, it's going to exactly do that. So again, the only limitation is going to be your imagination in terms of how you can write these prompts. And that is going to be a real key thing. You know, before the art was writing an effective search term. Now it's going to be about effective prompt writing, all about prompts. So the content you get out is merely going to be predicated on the prompts that you put in, and your ability to think and to construct those prompts to guide it to create the content. So amazing, absolutely amazing. And we have seen some examples, you know, particularly synthetic content. So there are some particular issues with image and video creation. So it is really good. And certainly on a first glance, image content that DALL-E, Midjourney, all creates is remarkable. But there are some things that it struggles with. So one often giveaway telling some is hands.
I noticed that.
It struggles, particularly index fingers, that they can be really long. For some reason, hands, digits, fingers, and it finds difficult. So you can usually tell, or mostly tell, if an image is synthetic by looking at the hands. With video, some of the examples we've seen, you've got somebody walking along, and what's sometimes a bit strange, again, we've seen examples where it doesn't quite do hands properly, or you have a long thumb and a long finger. But also when you've got somebody in a video that's walking along a pavement, in actual fact, their foot seems to move on the pavement surface. So it's just these little telltale signs that you can sometimes tell if it's synthetic or not. And as we get onto issues, you know, so we've talked about how extraordinary the technology is, but we get onto issues, and there are a number. There are a number of issues, not least bias, you know. So with a search on the internet, you get these 25,000 responses. What you're going to find is that you have a spectrum, you have an array of different bias in responses, and it's up to you to pick the right one. What we're going to find now is that the synthesis takes all of that in the round, and so it's going to inherently have bias in it. And so there needs to be an awareness of that. So if you're writing something, you need to think about the training data and the bias in terms of what it presents. You need to actually, if you want to make a point, you have to be explicit about the point you want to make in the text prompt that you write to get the generative AI system to give you the content you want. So things as well, like as plagiarism. Plagiarism is an obvious one. And so particularly if we're talking about children, the concerns around children have been set a piece of work to write you an essay about this. Well, it's dead easy just to then write in ChatGPT, write me this essay. It takes a couple of seconds to write you a 2,000-word essay on this particular subject. Now, that's that's not improving anyone's knowledge. And if you copy and paste it, it's clearly wrong. And we have seen lots of universities now starting to ban ChatGPT, and some schools as well. I'd say ChatGPT, generative AI, which we don't agree with. I mean, clearly you shouldn't be copying and pasting the output, because inherently it's going to be aspects of it that are wrong.
Or the same, if so many people ask the same thing.
Yes. And there's, we might come back to that. So I say, copying and pasting is wrong, but then so is banning it. We think, you know, you can go into a library, you can get a book out, you can copy the text out of the book, and you can use that. And then that's clearly wrong as well. But we don't ban libraries, or indeed books. But and so, if it's used properly, what an amazing start to children. I've got this essay I've got to write. Can you help me structure it? What are the points I need to think about? What sort of tone should I use? What are the different arguments? And so get it to prompt you to think about the subject so you can kind of learn. And then it can learn with you and it can help you to then construct. Well, can you help me write this little bit here? Or I want to write an emphasis here. So that's the art, I think, of using generative AI kind of going forwards in terms of plagiarism. Another one, and perhaps an obvious one, is what we refer to as hallucination. So when generative AI makes stuff up. So the training data that all generative AI, you know, it large data sets, but it's all historical.
Okay.
An example. Asking ChatGPT, create me a 20-word quiz on music from the 1980s. I want 4 responses and tell me the right answer. And it's going to produce you 20 amazing questions about music from the 1980s. Then you can ask it, okay, write me a quiz about a 20-word quiz about Easter 2024. I want 4 answers and tell me the right one. And it's going to produce you a 20-word quiz with different answers. Inherently, they're all going to be wrong because it doesn't know about stuff that happens recently because the training data doesn't necessarily cover it.
Okay.
But it will present it to you in exactly the same way. Which is why we refer to this as hallucination. So if it doesn't know, it just makes it up. And your job, our job, is to try to work out and to pick out the bits that are true and the bits that are false. And so relying on it, once it presents it and it creates it in exactly the same way, it can just make it up. And the final issue to do with generative AI, which we refer to, is around cannibalism, which is a bit of a weird word to use. As we go down, you know, and training data that these models are trained on, the content that's being created over the course of the last year or two, lots of it is going to be generative AI created. Even now, that training data that's now being trained on the latest models is going to include that content. So the content it's learning from is the content that it created with all that kind of bias. And the point you made earlier on about you can often tell if someone uses the generative AI, so it may well look the same. Well, if you're now training models on the output that it gave earlier on, that's a cyclical motion. It's starting to ingest its own output. An analogy that we often try to give to parents of young children. You know, you ask a very young child to go and paint a picture, and they've got all these different paint pots with different colours in. It doesn't matter what colour you use, the picture always usually turns out brown. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's children just kind of painting about stuff. And that's what I think is going to happen to generative AI in time. you start to eat your own content, and the content will become kind of bland and uniform, because it's just eating. It's going to go round and round and round in a vicious circle. So hence referred to as cannibalism.
So does that mean that in time we will, well, make it not work good?
I think, you know, you could, by volume, if you've got the really great stuff, playwrights or authors who have written great content and very thought-provoking content, when you've got generative AI that's producing lots more content, but based on that, by volume, that's the generative AI output is going to be bigger than the original author's work. And so you'll start to potentially shift the volumes in terms of data sets. So it will start to shift that content. And it, then for, as I say, I'll potentially go back into bias and all sorts of things. But the point here is about when you start to ingest stuff in terms of your earlier output, you learn from it. Yeah, it's not necessarily going to help.
After hearing you explain how AI can be used, I noticed that a lot of children are using AI exactly that way, to generate images, to generate text, for everything. It is so widely spread, and it is really available. It is not just for some people only. It is like more available than ever.
Oh, yeah.
So are children aware of the risks?
And you know, it's going to get so much more so as well. So we now start to see AI being integrated into devices, so you won't need to be connected. You wouldn't have to be connected to the internet in order for it to be working. So we've seen Sony introduce it into chipsets on cameras, was the first time, you know. So when you're taking an image, there's actually AI integrated into the device. We've seen the new iPhones, new Samsung phones kind of coming out, Android phones coming out with AI integrated on chipsets. That's going to, you know, it's not a case of going to use generative. It will be integrated into everything that we do. Again, opportunities and but also associated risks with that in all the things that we've kind of talked about already. So, but yeah, there'll be much more use. It's not going to be a technology that you'll go and use, a bit like social media is or has been as well. You know, social media is just kind of in the background. It's a technology that's there that you just go and dip in and out of. It's not a conscious thing. It's AI is going to be just the same, but it will fundamentally revolutionize and change how we interface with technology.
But with the children using it and the parents being kind of afraid of it, how can we maybe close the gap between the two? I don't know, do you think that maybe some institution like school or some organization should play a role of educating parents? Because now we see kids educating parents instead the other way around.
It's an eternal challenge, and always has it been the way. So worked in this space for 20, 25 years, and parental or parents' involvement has always been a challenge. Back in 2001, there was a guy, Mark Prensky, who coined this expression: there are digital natives and there are digital immigrants. And what he was trying to do, I think, was to really encapsulate that adults at the time had to learn to adapt to this technology, whereas children, it was totally normal and totally natural. Yeah. And so that's what he was trying to do. Oh gosh, over the course of the last decade or so, that approach, I think, has got some real problems with it. Because what it does is we find that it just gives adults or parents, it gives them agency to say, this to children, this is just such their world. You know, my children are perfectly able to pick up a device and to kind of to use it. And so, you know, that just gives you agency to not worry, because, yeah. But what it does is it makes a big confusion. Children are fearless when it comes to technology. We're perfectly happy to pick it up, use it, navigate around. We don't have that same inherent fear that adults have about what's it going to do is it going to go wrong? Am I going to delete something? You know,
exactly,
all
yes.
of those kind of risks that are associated that are in an adult's head, children do not have. And so what that does is it just merely confuses confidence with capability. By mm-hmm. saying that, yep, they're perfectly fine with it. Yeah, they're fine to pick it up and having a go with it, but they're still children. They still don't comprehend risk in the same way adults do, in the same way that, you know, if a child was climbing a tree, climbing the tree at the bottom, there's not much risk with that. You can kind of see that. But if it gets higher, you know, that's when you need to get involved as a parent. The risk of falling out of the tree and falling, the further you fall, clearly the more harm you can do. And so that's why it's the wrong, so digital natives and digital immigrants is the wrong approach to this. And certainly for any parents listening, please, please do not confuse a child's confidence with their capability. So always has this been the issue. So what's the answer? Well, I'm not entirely sure there is an answer, because as I say, I've been spending 25 years and I still haven't found an answer, because the technology's always been, has always developed. We had social media, we had the internet to start with, then we had social media, then we had kind of mobile technologies. Now we've got generative AI. It's just the latest version of technology that just takes children, you know, ahead of adults or of parents. But I would say engage with it. Mm-hmm. Have a conversation with it, or get children, learn with children, particularly if they're younger children, it's a lot easier. By the time they get to teenagers, it's often a whole lot harder to engage. But hopefully by that stage, you'll have had that understanding and on that journey kind of, if you like, together. But it is all about dialogue and discussion. There's loads of information online, perhaps some say too much information mm-hmm. online. But just, you know, if it's generative AI, just go and kind of ask it. Give it a go now. So we're clearly joined here by ChatGPT latest version. ChatGPT, it's difficult for parents to learn or to understand how their children are online. Can you give us some advice? What would you say? How would you suggest parents should learn about you? You can come in now. And at that point, it doesn't.
Children use online tools like me, it's important to start by exploring together. Ask your child to show you what they're interested in and how they use AI. Have open conversations about what they find fun or useful, and share your concerns and set boundaries where needed. There are plenty of resources available online, from parental guides to workshops, that can help you get up to speed. And remember, it's okay not to have all the answers. Learning together can be a great way to bond.
So there we go, from the horse's mouth. There's clearly the ChatGPT answer to how to engage parents with generative AI technology. I'm sure there's going to be more information as well as we go on, but thank you for now.
Glad I could help.
No problem.
I'm here if you need anything else. Great. I'll be here if you need me. Just let me know.
That's a great way of using it. I noticed that when we try as an organization to educate parents on some new things that are appearing in the digital world, there's a lot of information for them to grasp their head, to wrap their head around. So mainly we focus on the risks, because it is a lot easier, because they maybe... they don't know what AI is, and they are not really interested in knowing. But, we can keep them interested if we tell them all about how children are misusing AI. But that comes with a risk that we are always that we're making of digital world something that is really scary, really bad, and that we should all ban everything and go into the woods because we're safe there.
You're absolutely right. That we do often focus, and also with children, I think. So there was a There was a seminal moment for us back in 2014. And a really important moment that there was a campaign launched in the UK called Dare to Care. It doesn't really matter, but it was a campaign about online safety and exploitation that was launched. And as part of the launch, it was launched by a politician. So bear in mind, we'd been working in this space at that point for 10, 15 years. And this was a subject that we were really familiar with, exploitation of children. So part of this campaign launch, they had a victim from, we had a child sexual abuse, we had a number of UK-based child sexual abuse scandals. And there was a victim from one of these scandals. And she was a victim of exploitation or grooming and exploitation when she was 14 at the time. And a journalist asked her the question, did you not cover this at school in terms of grooming and exploitation? And she said, which was our light bulb moment, she said, I did, but I didn't think it applied to me, so I didn't listen to it. Oh. And you think, ooh, why is that? We as a nation had been spending a lot of effort on trying to educate. So we're trying to think, well, how have we been wasting our time? What's going on? So we start to think about, well, perhaps the approach we're taking is wrong. And what we arrived at was, and this is from a school and sort of formal education perspective. We arrived at becoming critical of those schools who have what we refer to as a manufacturing approach to online safety. So you have a whole year group of children, 300-400 children, wheeled into a school hall, and they're shown a video, and then they're wheeled out. And then the next year group kind of come in, they're shown the same video, and it's like a conveyor belt of children. They're shown a video. The video is usually around exploitation, and often extreme exploitation, on the basis of, well, if we show children what exploitation looks like, or exploitation and grooming looks like, they'll be able to recognise it and avoid it. Now, to your point, when you learnt to drive a car, you didn't just sit down and watch films of car crashes.
Exactly, yeah.
It does not teach you to drive a car. And so that was our, you know, this was our moment. It's like, perhaps we're tackling this from completely the wrong end. And if children can't sit, and to be fair, if you're watching exploitation, who's going to see themselves in that situation? That's nothing to do with me. It's just like watching the TV. It's like entertainment.
Exactly.
So, therefore, we've concluded that we're tackling this from the wrong end. Let's try the other end. So rather than telling children what they shouldn't do, let's teach children what they should do. And starting at year age 4 and age 5, every year a child goes by to describe what the digital competencies are that they should have. So if I'm a parent of a 10-year-old, well, to be honest, I only really need to know what a 10-year-old should be capable of. We've already said there's so much information online. If I've got a 10-year-old, I don't need to know what a 7-year-old. So I just need to know what my 10-year-old, or if I'm teaching a 10-year-old, what that 10-year-old should be capable of. And each year, these skills and competencies should grow. In every other sense of any of the curriculum subject, the approach that we take. So that was a genesis moment for us. And it started a huge project around what is now Project Evolve, that got launched in September 2021. A digital competency framework, and then kind of activities associated with that you know, you can apply, you can give to children at every age group. So focusing on what you can, what you should be able to do, rather than telling them what they shouldn't be able to do. So we've kind of turned it all on its head. So it comes back to your point, particularly of parents. It's a natural thing, I think, for parents just to have to be concerned. And when we run parent sessions, when anyone runs parent sessions, often there is a tendency to focus on all the harm, because that's what parents need to know. And to be fair, they do need that knowledge. I think you have an understanding of what the risks are, but not in isolation. It's got to be tempered with why children are using it, what the opportunities are, why should we be using this technology, what it can do for you, you know, as well as you need to kind of be careful about, so if children, I say be careful of, so the amount of time that children are spending on their screens, which is the interminable and universal the world over challenge that parents have in terms of how you manage screen time. Get off the screen or get off the console those conversations happen, again, the world over. But we might come back to that. So thinking about both not just the harm but the opportunity is a really important. So how you can use this technology, how it can make your life better, your family better. An example, there are some great parental tools out there to help manage screen time. You might find, and anecdotally speaking, I know from personal experience, this works. If you tell a child, look, you've had enough time on your screen, now come off, you get either ignored or you get moaning and groaning. Mm. or just, I'm not doing that yet. If you put a timer on the device, and the time and the device says time's up, they seem to accept that much more readily than if a parent says it.
Maybe because it feels like a game.
Perhaps. But your time's up. So they just put it down. So, you know, example of some technology in terms of parental control technologies that are actually built into all devices or most devices. And it's all just there ready for parents to use. You just have to know how, you have to know A, that it's there, and then B, how to kind of set it up. So,
well, speaking of what children are able to do at a specific age, we noticed in our reports that children are making horrible things using technology. So it is scary, and we noticed in our organization that parents or educators who notice those things are not able to believe that children are creating that kind of content. So I'm speaking of, for our listeners, I'm speaking of children generating horrible pictures of their peers that are sexually, with a sexual connotation. And those pictures are spread in groups, group chats, used to bully. They are not doing their homework anymore. They're just using ChatGPT for all of that. So we are really deep down in a lot of trends that are circling, and our kids are using technology to harm their peers. And I wanted to ask you maybe about some specific trends that you noticed in your report, in your work. So maybe we can, put those here for parents and educators to further research.
So it's definitely true. It is very true that children, in fact, anybody and everybody can use the technology for harmful purposes, which is a really sad thing, I think. But always has it been the way. I think, you know, we refer to in this case, in one particular case, you know, it's technology-facilitated abuse or technology-facilitated gender-based violence in some cases. That's an important phrase, I think. So technology facilitated. It's not the technology that does this. It's people. Yes, the technology enables it or facilitates it, but it's still fundamentally the action of individuals. And I say as well, so always has this been the case. You know, children can be very cruel sometimes. Always heard it as well, say that if ever a school says to you that we don't have bullying here, never send your child there. You know, it just means that you either don't know about it, rather than it's not happening, because it happens everywhere. I think it's kind of built in. So with that in mind, it's all about, in this case, using the technology, putting across, you know, that there are rights and wrongs, there's kind of values that you should have in all of this, which parents should, schools should be doing. You know, tech platforms all have community standards that describe, you know, what's acceptable on their platforms and what's not acceptable on their platforms. So harassment, for example, is usually a violation of terms, community standards of terms and conditions. You know, that's that little box that, you know, when you sign up for a service, you register for a service and you tick, say, yes, I've read and understood that.
I agree.
Yeah, which clearly everyone reads and understands. But the biggest lie of the 21st century, as it said. But contained in there is information around, you know, what our community stands for. And like I say, harassment is usually, in most platforms, certainly most mainstream platforms, not acceptable. And so, you know, if you use that platform or you use that technology for harassment, you run the risk of being kicked out, or your account being suspended, or and then account being deleted, depending on the particular platform. And that's the same thing as values that parents have, that families have, that schools have, that other organisations have. You know, you live by these values and you try to give those to children, don't we? The art, I think, particularly for social media, is, well, if you have got these values, yes, you've got reporting mechanisms, but also you should have mechanisms to detect and identify where that harassment takes place. That's what we had a report about, what we refer to as harmful sexual behaviour. So it's, if you like, the extent of sexually charged language. So this goes back to, actually it was a website that was created in the UK called Everyone's Invited in 2020. Mm-hmm. It was a website that was created to enable anybody to post what they refer to as anonymous testimonies to describe the sexual harassment or sexual abuse that they've experienced or suffered, citing the school, university where that took place. And today, there's something like 50,000 testimonies that people have anonymously published on that website. So that was sufficient to kick off some research around sexual abuse in schools and colleges. Part of it, they surveyed 1,000 children, and they concluded that 74% of concluded that harmful sexual behaviour, sexually charged language is, and I'm using specific language here, normal and common. So 74% of girls routinely receive unwanted sexual images. The majority receive requests for intimate images. This sexually charged language. One of the things we'd really love to see is, so I should add, there's so much language that it's normal and they don't do anything about it anymore. We don't report it. We don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, we normalize it.
Wouldn't it be great if there was like some technology that can sit and if it reads the sorts of comments that are being directed at you or that you're kind of peripheral, and it's like, hang on a minute, that's not right. They shouldn't be able to say that sort of thing. Just as a trigger to somebody's head in receipt of that, it's like, hang on a minute, no, that's not right. You should not have to stand for that. You might want to report, or here's some things you might want to do. I mean, clearly you can ignore it, but there are also some things to do if there's a lot of it, for example. So I think it would be great to get some kind of neat technology like that, and I think generative AI is exactly the sort of thing that could well provide that nudge and provide that tap on the shoulder. Hey, hang on a minute. Just a bit like they just did just then. You kind of more kind of conversational.
Well, I read that your organization collaborates with TikTok and that they are using actually generative AI for detecting harassment on their platform. And my question, the first thing I thought, well, that's a great way of using AI because it is a lot faster than AI is faster than people. But is it able to detect everything? Or are we people more prone to detect it and know what's actual harassment and what's not?
So it's a great question. When we're talking about TikTok, we can talk about a number of different platforms here, I think. So there is, and I forget the exact, the sorts of numbers, but the majority, if we read the more recent transparency report, so tech platforms now, as a result of kind of new regulations, you know, if I look at Australia or New Zealand, the UK, which is coming in, the Digital Services Act in Europe, require platforms to publish what they refer to as transparency reports. Mm-hmm. So reports that sort of disclose aspects around the operations of platforms, and so the number of cases they manage, the number of reports that they make. And what it does disclose in many of the cases is that, yeah, so platforms usually remove content before anyone's actually seen it, based on some of the moderation technologies that they use. That said, it's not 100% effective. It removes the bulk, but it doesn't remove all of it. Mm-hmm. Now that also suggests too that the abuse that you do receive is actually a minority of the abuse that was actually destined. In the same way that email, again for email, you know, your inbox and your email inbox is only represent a small percentage of the emails that are ever sent to you. The vast, vast bulk of emails, 95% of emails that are destined for you, are all removed at source by kind of spam blockers and by your email mechanisms. So there are a number of effective filters that do kind of help to filter out some of the worst and the unwanted content. But like I say, it's not 100%. That's why there's reporting mechanisms. And again, I would very much encourage anybody and everybody, if there's something that you're not comfortable with on a platform, report it. All the platforms have reporting mechanisms, and there's usually a report button at the bottom of every single page to report abuse or to report something. Go use it. Because sometimes the platforms don't know about it. Mm-hmm. Many of the technologies kind of are automated. So go report content. We actually spent some time, so reportharmfulcontent.com, a platform we launched back in 2019 that tries to give confidence to people. You know, people don't often report stuff. Perhaps it's because it's normal or whatever, but you know, what we're trying to do here is if you're experiencing abusive content on Facebook, well, click here and report it this way. If I'm experiencing impersonation on X, well, click here, do this. You know, so instructions about how to go and report content. So not just, I mean, there is a report, there's usually a report button at the bottom of every page. Just go and report that.
Exactly, because now from this conversation, I get that by not using that reported button, because most of us don't use it, we are actually normalizing everything. So instead of that, we could all report and there will be a lot less than harmful content on the internet. So
one of the things with TikTok, and we've been doing this now for coming up for 3 years, is that we operate a number of helplines in the UK. We support those that work with children. We have found that children have been creating explicit and obscene accounts on TikTok, often targeting schools and teachers, like impersonation accounts. So what we've been doing in the background is that schools directly report that to us, and then we expedite that process with TikTok operations to get content and accounts removed. And we've removed thousands and thousands and thousands, and we continue to remove thousands of accounts where that is clearly a violation of terms of service or community standards. So TikTok are great at then just then actioning those reports and taking those accounts down, like they should do.
Yeah, that's a great way of collaborating on a specific issue, because when you have a collaboration, that means when two or, I don't know, five organizations or people collaborate, then it is such a global thing. Mm. But when you focus on that one, it is really great, because I'm now interested. Why are kids making so much so much of those accounts that are impersonating teachers?
It's a great question, and I don't know the answer to it, I'm afraid.
What are they posting there?
It's a variety of different things, but it's usually, if I go back years, there was a website that was created called Rate My Teacher. Rate My Teacher was, it's been taken down since, but it was a website where you can go and, if you're at school, there'll be a list of teachers and you could kind of rate, essentially a bit like TripAdvisor, but children are not they were very kind in some cases, but more so in looking at when, I don't know, if we didn't get on with a particular teacher, or, I don't know, you may well have been given extra homework or something that you didn't want, and then taking it out against that teacher. So again, it's nothing necessarily new, but we have found in the UK, and TikTok do tell us that it is just the UK, taking to TikTok to post all sorts of abusive and explicit and obscene content about the teachers that they have.
Wow. We tackled a lot of interesting subjects.
Then I was going to just go on. There was one extra bit that I wanted to, I mean, because it stems off of TikTok as well. Mm-hmm. It comes back to something you mentioned too around children sharing synthetic or deepfake content, so generative AI content, sexualized content of their peers. Not just their peers. We find children are also creating, in some cases, synthetic deepfake content of their teachers. I will add, it's not limited to children. So one of the helplines we operate in the UK and have done now for nearly 10 years is the Revenge Porn Helpline. So we support adults in the UK who are victims of non-consensual intimate image abuse. And the last few years, we've seen a big rise in terms of synthetic content where... I'm being specific here. Often the internet will talk about deepfake content. We refer to it as synthetic, non-consensual, intimate image abuse. But fundamentally the same thing. So where somebody else created intimate images of you using pornographic content or generative AI, nudification apps, that are bizarrely freely available, despite them not... by being a violation of App Store community standards. That's been a particular rise. One of the things, again, kind of TikTok, is the sharing of non-consensual intimate image abuse, whether it's children or adults, or if you're being threatened to have your intimate images shared online, which we found is a big issue. Or at least over years gone by, is a big issue. And having the threat of somebody sharing your intimate images can be at least as impactful as actually having your intimate images shared online. The fear of somebody having that content and posting at any moment, you can just kind of imagine. In December 2021, we launched... technology that discharges that threat. So if someone is threatening to post your intimate images online, there's two websites here. So one is the one we created, was stopnci.org. This is for adults. So stopnci non-consensual intimate image abuse.org. That's for adults. Children is takeitdown.netmec.org. So takeitdown.ncmec.org. So that's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in the States. We gave the technology to them to create it for children. So children is Take It Down, adults is Stop NCII. You visit the website. You have to have a copy of your image, your intimate image or your video. It's usually, we find that you usually do anyway. And on your device, you create what's called a hash of that image or video. It's like a digital fingerprint that uniquely identifies that image or video. The image or video always remains on your device, but the hash code goes, we instantly adds onto the data bank, and we then share that with, so we share that today with Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Reddit, OnlyFans, Pornhub, Snap, Niantic, Microsoft, Bing. There's 12 platforms to enable them to prevent anybody else anywhere in the world posting that particular image or that video on their platforms. So it discharges the threat. So in terms of, well, firstly, extraordinary use of technology, we have something we're so proud of, because last weekend we went through there's a million images and videos that around the world that we're protecting. There are practical things you can do if you're having that threat placed upon you, whether you're a child or whether you're an adult. And so merely going to use that utility on those websites, like I say, stopnci.org, takeitdown.netmec.org, you can then instantly prevent that from being posted on those particular platforms. There's 12 platforms that we partner with and 12 NGOs around, 100 NGOs around the world. So 12 platforms, there should be thousands of platforms taking this. And so again, if there are platforms, companies listening to this that have content could be posted on their platforms, then they should be using the hash technology that we have to prevent and make their platforms hostile to anyone else posting and abusing somebody through posting intimate images without anyone's consent.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. I actually wrote an article about Take It Down because I found it really helpful, because a lot of children are having those problems. So when there's a particular answer to the problem, why not share it? So thank you for this explanation, because it explained it a lot better than I did, because hashing was maybe a complicated issue, a complicated topic for me. Yeah, but I just remember that I didn't use AI to explain it to me, so maybe I should have.
No, so we've done that as well. We've tried to use ChatGPT to explain how hashing works, and it does do a great job with it.
We spoke a lot of subjects and tackled a lot of things, and I think that I could go forever like this, because I have so many questions. As we are to wrap things up, what is one, and this is challenging, what is one key message that you want to leave parents and educators with? How they could navigate in this digital world without being afraid, without scaring their children or banning everything? What is one key message?
That is, as you say, immensely, immensely hard. I think the one thing that I would probably say for parents is, which I always criticize myself for saying this, but if there's any one thing, it would have to be have a conversation with children about their use of technology. If there was only one, it would be a conversation. I think, and perhaps the easiest way of doing that, and depends on the age of the child, but is have a voyage through their device. You know, go along the various different screens, and then have an explore with them, a journey through the apps that they use and why they use them and what they get out of them and you know, how they use that, what those different apps do for them. The ones you want to be most sensitive to or aware of are the ones, the accounts that you log into, or the apps where you've got accounts that you log into, given that you're probably likely to store information within those sorts of accounts, or indeed you've got contact details within those. But that's if there's one thing, that's what it would be for parents. For teachers or for educators, again, I think it's making sure that formal education, online safety features as part of formal education. So not necessarily focusing on the harms that we talked about, but thinking about the different digital skills that children should have, digital competencies that they should have, the kind of media literacy or digital literacy. Mm-hmm. And how do you know that they're actually acquiring those particular skills and competencies? So I think that's what it would. Though if there was one each, it would be, that's what it would be.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this conversation. And sorry for my English, because I know I made some mistakes, but I will first of all forgive myself, and then try not to think about it later.
You did a great job, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Ovo je bilo još jedna epizoda Bezbedne priče. Hvala vam što ste gledali, hvala vam što ste slušali. Pre nego što odete, želim da vam kažem da u našem web shopu možete da pronađete mnogo knjiga koje se dotiču upravo ove teme, tako da vam savjetujem da odete da pogledate na našem sajtu www.cnzd.rs. A do sljedeće epizode možete da svratite do našeg Instagrama i pogledate neke isečke od epizoda koje smo ranije snimili, da premostite do sljedeće epizode koja će biti uploadovana na naš kanal. Vidimo se!